Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This program was brought to you by the Academy Opus Caseus, whose training programs bring cheese professionals to the next level.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Cutting the Curd. This is your host, Greg Blaze. We have a great show for you today, focusing on the Pacific Northwest and some new and exciting stuff coming out of there. In the studio, I'd love to welcome Anna Jewel, a.k.a. Mama Jewel, as my co-host. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, Greg. It's great to be here. Thanks.
You may remember Anna from a couple of past episodes as the founder of Cheese Journeys, a company focused on cheese-centric travel. After the break, she's going to talk to us about an amazing trip to Oregon that she's organized. Sounds pretty fun, and I hope I can go. But first, on the line, we have Dan Utano, cheesemaker and production manager of Ferndale Farmstead Creamery in Washington State. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Dan, and giving us a little bit of your time.
Yeah, not a problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we appreciate it. You know, I would love it if, you know, you could, I'd love to hear about the Ferndale Farmstead Creamery. I don't know it. So maybe you can start by telling us a little about the operation and what kind of cheeses you make out there.
Sure. Well, we are brand new. We've actually just the past 2 weeks been making our first batches of cheese. So it's a really exciting time right now. As our name says, we're a farmstead operation. We are a dairy farm in Ferndale, Washington, which is just south of the British Columbia border. The nearest city to us is Vancouver in terms of major cities. We're close to Vancouver than Seattle. And then Bellingham is a little more of the closest hub kind of civilization here. So we're a dairy farm, and we're milking right on the farm. And we just built about 20 feet away a creamery. And we're currently making all Italian-style cheeses, and we're basing that off of... Originally, the idea kind of came from the idea that there's really not anybody out here doing that. And, you know, we don't want to be... we don't want to just be another small player, so we kind of want to be somebody who can kind of come in and take the Pacific Northwest cheese scene by storm, kind of join in the likes of Rogue and Point Reyes and kind of become a household name like that. We've currently have our head cheese maker, Rafael Mascolo, and he's been making cheese in Italy and the United States for over 30 years.
That's fantastic.
And we've also, over the past couple of weeks, have had an assortment of people from Italy out here. We have dairy scientists and technicians out here. And really our goal is to be making Italian cheese in America that tastes like it's coming from Italy, really something that we think is kind of in great need here. And hopefully we can really bring out a real authentic flavor and something that obviously we're very proud of, but is also something that is very indicative of the culture.
I agree. I mean, I work for Eataly, so I eat an enormous amount of Italian cheese. And, you know, one thing that I notice a lot, and, you know, Italian cheese is, I don't know what, when you say you're going to make Italian cheese, are you regional specific? Are you going to make cheeses from the Veneto? Are you going to try to make some Asiago? Are you going to try to make some Crucolo? Or what are you making out there for Italian cheese?
We're gonna, that's a great question. We're going to be making an assortment of cheeses. We are up to making a lot of mozzarella, specifically fior di latte, and that we're actually going to be using cultures. We're not going to be using vinegar in our milk at all. It is all culture-based, so we really feel like then, obviously, it'll be cow's milk. perhaps down the line we might invest in some water buffalo, but right now it's all cow's milk, but culture of Tierra de Leche. And then we're also going to be doing an assortment of aged cheeses. Today is a pretty exciting day. Today we made our first test batch of Grana.
Oh, wow.
So we're doing, you know, we're doing some Grana. We're not doing full size, about 45-pound wheels of Grana, which is still pretty big.
Yeah, that's a larger cheese.
And then we're going to be doing some different stuff, cacciota and caciocavallo. You know, we'll be able to do a lot of cacciota, get that out, 2-3 weeks age max, doing some caciocavallo. We've done test batches of Asiago, Fontina. We're really set up so that we can do a lot of assortments of cheeses, and right now, doing test batches, it's more of seeing what works well here, what works best with our milk, and at a certain point, turning it over to the market and seeing what the market's going for. And we're hoping to do a little bit fresh, a little bit aged, and really having a variety of products there.
Yeah, well, you got to have the Fior de Latte, you got to have the mozzarella, because you got to make money. You got to be able to make cheese and get it out there and get money coming back in. You know, maturing those Grana and Asiago for 6-8 months, you know, you got to, you know, that's an investment in time and money. So, you know,
really?
I can understand what you're talking about there. Do you find that the climate and just the I hate that word, but the terroir there, does it mimic any portion of Italy that the dairy scientists and the people that you're bringing over, you know, do they when they come over, do they say, hey, this reminds me of the Valle d'Aosta, or this reminds me of the Veneto, or are they like,
you know,
where the fuck am I right now?
Have a little bit, because we're in an interesting area, and we're right by the water. And we're in the lowlands, but if you look out the window from our creamery, you have a beautiful view of the Cascades and Mount Baker right above us. So I've asked them if this reminds them at all of anywhere, you know, if this reminds them of Northern Italy or anything, and kind of have some mixed answers. We actually have people here from all over. Our dairy scientist here is from Naples. So... the big thing is, you know, is really, is do we have, the first question is, do we have the milk to do it? And the answer was believed to be yes. We, you know, we have the milk to do it. We have a wide mix of cows here. It's a mix of Holsteins, Jerseys, and we even have some Montpellier cows here.
Nice.
And yep. And we have a separator too. So we are separating cream out. You know, we're not just doing full fat. So for something like Grana, we're trying to hit an ideal fat content that you would find in an Italian Grana, and same with some of the different styles. So we're able to play with the milk a little bit to try and get what the real Italian scientists believe is the secrets to really hitting their flavors.
Have you ever seen Grana production over there in Italy?
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. Well, Parmigiano and Grana production are that's a pretty interesting thing to see when you get over there. That's tough to replicate over here. I mean,
yeah. Well, we're not. There'll be some subtle differences. We're not dipping the cloth right into the vat. When it's time to press our cheese and hoop it, we're draining into a drain table and pressing under the whey in a drain table, and then cutting slabs and going from the slabs into the hoop. So some subtle differences, but ultimately, you know, the flavor is what we're going for. We obviously won't know till 8 months, 9 months, a year how this really is doing in terms of coming close to, you know, a real Parm or a real Grana. But our cultures are all coming from Italy. Our rennets all coming from Italy, and from a very small culture house that really does not distribute to the U.S. very much. So
you're getting the good stuff, is
again,
what you're saying.
You know, yeah. So again, we're kind of just trying to do something really unique here, and we're hoping we really get good, flavorful cheese that you really don't find much outside of Italy.
And I hope you do too. I love. I recently. And well, not recently. I mean, I've always bought and sold a little bit of cheeses from from the Pacific Northwest, but they're mostly been soft ripened cheeses. And the Cascadia Creamery, they make the Sawtooth out there, which I love. Washed rind organic cow. And my buddy Pierre Kolisch, who I don't know if he's even making cheese anymore. He's from Oregon, but I mean, I've always loved the cheeses from in and around there. And even though I've never been there, I feel like I have because of the type of cheese. But I've never really gotten the cheeses that you're talking about making from there. So I wish you the best of luck, and you know, I hope you sell me some cheese, you know, when you get it done, you know.
Yeah. When we ramp up production, we're looking to pretty much sell it to whoever wants it. So big, small, doesn't matter to us.
You'll be there for us. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about something. You know, I'm loath to go on social media. It's not really my thing. I'm kind of a Luddite, but I read. And I was reading something that you posted. You just posted this amazing cheese rant on Facebook. And I love to rant a lot myself. When I took over as the host of Cutting the Curd, their biggest problem with me was that they thought I was going to curse too much. And so I really, really tried not to do that. And I think I've done a good job because I'm still doing it. But I'd love to talk a little bit more about what you said. So, you know, in your new operation, you're working with Italian dairy scientists and cheesemakers to develop recipes based on the milk your cows are producing. Your rant was all about a conversation you had with a fellow cheesemaker about the importance of cultures and science versus the perceived art of cheesemaking, the craft and the cheesemaker's hands in the vat. So I would wonder if you could tell me a little bit more about why you think this is an important topic in cheese today, outside of what you said.
Well, I think there's two points you can go on, and one is in terms of like food safety, there's in terms of quality, which for, I guess, intensive purposes right now, we could kind of combine it to the same basic idea. Is right now more than any, I think right now more than any other time, at least in the United States, there are more people making cheese, more people trying to make cheese. I feel like I'm constantly meeting new people or hearing about new people that are getting into cheese making, and not just on a home level, but actually on an intent to sell level.
How do you feel about that?
I think it's great and it's not great. I think it's a great idea. I think it's great to think that there could be more cheeses coming up, a higher interest in it. Obviously, it's probably, you know, it's based on a better market interest in cheese, which is great. It's great for everyone. But I think it also does two things. It, in many ways, brings the rise of mediocre cheese, or, you know, saturates the market.
I agree with that.
Mediocrity, you know, floods like our farmers markets with people doing the same thing, or just making, like I said, what I kind of often see as mediocre cheese. And what becomes way more serious is when it saturates the market with unsafe cheese. People who don't understand proper sanitation or disregard proper sanitation, or in some cases aren't willing to spend the money on proper cleaning and sanitation and testing.
Anna, you seem to want to chime in on that.
No, I'd have to agree. It poses some other, you know, related issues that are even bigger than the initial ones we were talking about. So how does that get regulated? What standards are there going to be out there going forward? And how do we continue to look at these as the cheese industry, the artisanal or farmstead type cheese industry is wonderful to see it growing here in the U.S., but where do we see it in the next year or two, and what related issues are we going to have?
I mean, I'm with you, Dan. I think there's a lot of cheese out there, and I never want to discourage people from making cheese, and I don't think it's my place to do so. But I think there's a lot of stuff that tastes the same, and I wonder who's making it, and I wonder why they're making it. I mean, does that make sense, or I don't know?
Yeah, I agree. And that's sort of the question, and I think that kind of touches on the point I was at least trying to make to the person I was talking to, which is,
You still with us?
Most people are calling up the same culture source, and they're buying the same cultures. And what originally sparked this conversation was me saying that, you know, I wish that there was more outlets for cultures available in the U.S. because there becomes this homogeny of flavor. You know, whether you're in Vermont or whether you're in California, if you're pasteurizing your milk and putting in the same frozen cultures, you're probably getting a pretty similar flavor profile.
Well, that's science. That's how science works, right? I mean,
right. And you know what we're doing here, and I'll say right away, it's not even necessarily a conversation about pasteurized versus raw, because we're doing all pasteurized cheeses here, and we're really focusing on the quality of milk and our cultures to produce what we believe will be a unique flavor. And you know, the question came up: do we make a raw milk parm? And that be our only raw milk cheese? And you know, the scientists we're working on said, when I make this culture, it won't matter, pasteurized or raw. And we'll see. You know, we'll see in time. That's obviously a completely different debate. But, you know, so many people, there's very limited culture sources. You know, there's three main culture sources in the U.S., and that's Danisco, Cargo, and Chris Hansen. You know, if you're calling up, say, Dairy Connection, they're great. I love Dairy Connection, wonderful people. But you're going to possibly be buying the same exact culture as everybody else.
So what makes the cheese different?
Well, that depends. I mean, it depends on how you blend your cultures, what you do with your cultures once they go in the milk. Obviously, it's certainly part of it. It can be a difference in temperatures. It can also just be how well you look at what your cultures are doing and what you're doing with it in terms of how you monitor it, the trends you see.
Or can you speak to even, you know, with your cheese, how are you aging that cheese and what kind of conditions, temperatures, is there any difference than what you see in, you know, other producers?
It's possible. At least, you know, when I was previously working in the cheddar world, I used to have get a lot of inquiries of people who were starting up and making cheddar and trying to do bandage cheddar. And, you know, some of the first questions are, why is my cheese so crumbly or why is my cheese so dry and breaking apart? You know, it could have a lot to do with your temperature, humidity, but it could also have to do with your milk. It could have to do with what you're doing in your make, your pH. There's a lot that could go wrong in cheese making.
Yeah, of course.
You know, if it was an easy thing, everybody who did it would be wonderful at it.
But instead, what we seem to see is that, you know, we're pulling. Well, I don't want to be that guy. I agree with you. Basically, so what I agree with you. I want everybody to do anything that they want to do in life. Whatever you want to do in life, I want you to get it done and be happy doing it. But I think you should probably have a base knowledge of what you're doing before you go and start, you know, making cheese that's going to cost the same amount as very good cheese and maybe give the
marginal quality.
Yeah, marginal quality. I don't get that. No. Do you know what I mean?
Right. And it often strikes me as the question I always want to ask people when they say, you know, we've decided we're gonna build a creamery. I find a lot of people almost seems like that's what they want to do for their retirement. And it's like the two questions I ask her, why would you think cheese making would be like a fun way to spend your retirement? and two, what makes you think you could just do it? And it's almost insulting for those who have put a lot into learning to do it, you know, and what makes you think it's, say, easier than brewing, easier than winemaking? You know, why not make wine, might not brew, why cheese making?
Because it's hard.
Because somebody, you know, if it's because somebody loves cheese, then all the more power for them to do what they love. But if it's because you think it's easy, you should probably rethink what you're doing.
You know, I do have that same feeling. I'm just a cheesemonger. I know the process of making cheese. I love it. I've seen it. It's amazing. I feel like I have a good understanding of why I do what I do. And I run into that a lot with cheesemongers. You know, you get people who come to you and they're like, I want to be a cheesemonger. What's my first job? And I'm like, clean the fucking floor, man. You know what I mean? Like,
and the cooler.
Yeah. And the cooler. You see all that stuff there? Rewrap it, trim it, and then don't talk to me for the next 6 hours because I'm busy, man. You know what I mean? But I don't also, I think it's also a fine line because you don't, I don't, what I hate about our industry now is that, like, they're, everybody should work together, always. You know, you should always encourage people to want to be a cheesemaker or a cheesemonger. But I think what you're saying is that they should just understand the words that they use and the conversations that they're having, which brings me to my last point about your cheese rant. And a great thing that your rant was trying to distinguish between was an industrial, a farmstead, and an artisanal cheesemaker. And I hear these goddamn words get thrown around so much over the past. And I was wondering, I'm going to throw what I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong. Industrial cheese is cheese that's been being made by a machine, correct? It's like it. Right?
Short answer, yes.
Yes.
And I believe I actually believe in France, what they consider industrial is not necessarily made by a machine, although most of the industrial plants, I'm sure, are.
But it's a plant that makes it, right?
But it also has to do with the standardization of milk.
Right. So you have that,
right.
The short answer, only because I'd love to keep you, and I know you're busy. And then you have farmstead cheese, which means that the milk is being taken from animals that live on your farm. It's a closed herd, and that milk is being made into cheese at that farm. Correct?
Yes.
And then you have artisan cheese, which can be both. And my co-producer Emily and I were arguing because I was always taught way back, in my Jenkins book reading days, that an artisan cheesemaker is a handmaker, can buy milk from any herd they want, but they make the cheese by hand. Is that true?
I would say that's a pretty accurate assessment.
Anna, you look like you want to say something here.
No, I think that artisan cheese, or that definition of the word artisanal, has evolved a little bit and maybe encompasses a broader combination of those types of cheeses. So handmade, farmstead is a part of that, but there's also other cheese producers that are producing cheese and buying their milk somewhere else. Small batch, all those types of words, maybe it's an ongoing discussion.
What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, I would say at this point, a lot of those words have completely lost their meaning.
And I agree.
I think big or small, I kind of don't really care at this point.
Yeah, me
if it's
neither.
Good, if it's good, it's good. And I don't care how big you are or what you put into it. I think somebody like Rothkäse, I think their Grand Cru or Schwab's one of the best cheeses I've ever had.
Yeah,
I don't
that's
care
good stuff.
How big their creamery is or how mechanized part of that process might be. And I think that's where I go with the whole science versus not science. It's not about big or small to me, but I believe there's a lot of people who believe in doing something the right way, utilizing the data that exists, utilizing science. Whether you're doing it with your hands, whether you're stirring the vat with your hands, you're stirring the vat with a machine, it's what you understand about your milk, what you understand about your culture, how you taste, how you grade, how you evolve your cheese. That's what's going to define you. And, big, small, I don't care. Just give me good cheese.
You know what, man? I think that's a pretty awesome thing to say. And we're going to go to break and let you go back to doing what you do best, although you're pretty goddamn good on the radio. So if you want to come back up and talk to me, I'd love to. We're going to take a short break here on Cutting the Curd. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Mama Jewel about a cheese journey up. Maybe coming up your way, Dan, then.
Yeah, we're going to be in the Northwest next year, Dan. We might have to stop in.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, come on up. Come on up. We're happy to entertain.
Thanks so much,
Dan.
Thank you.
listening to Manufactured Consent. This is Cutting the Curd on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
The Academy Opus Caseus is the cheese industry's unique center for professional development, offering training for cheese professionals ready to move their careers to the next level. The Academy is the only professional cheese school integrating hands-on practice, formal instruction, and curriculum-related visits in every course. The Academy's core courses for mongers and affineurs are offered at the Mons facilities in France, and abridged courses are offered in Vermont, California, and London. A structured discipline of sensory analysis is practiced daily. The Academy has been recognized by the American Cheese Society as an approved education center for those preparing for the Certified Cheese Professional Exam. Here's a reading of a quote from Kevin Palmaccio, a graduate of the program.
The balance of time is what sets essential foundations apart from other educational opportunities. While the classroom is important, spending time at the goat farm and working alongside the Mons staff immersed us in real work and taught me real skills I've already applied in my career. As a relative newcomer to the cheese business, daily concentration on sensory analysis was paramount. As a cheesemonger, I'm now in a better position to familiarize myself with a wide range of products and sell with more confidence.
For more information and to apply for courses, visit their website at academy-mons.com. That's academie-mons.com.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd, broadcasting live on the Heritage Radio Network. That was a great first segment, and I want to thank Dan again for coming on. That was awesome. I love talking about stuff like that. So I'm here today with Anna Jewell of Cheese Journeys, one of my favorite people. I like all the Jewels. They're like the best.
They're just great.
And we're talking about exciting new ventures in the Pacific Northwest. Anna, it's really great to have you here, and it's a very exciting time for you, I'm sure, because you just announced a new cheese journey to Oregon. So I was wondering if you could remind our listeners about what Cheese Journeys is all about and maybe talk a little bit about this new trip.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Greg. You know, Cheese Journeys, again, is a boutique-style travel company that I founded in the last few years with the focus of really educating people, primarily cheese enthusiasts, but also professionals in the industry, as well as cheese beverage professionals, about the production of cheese on a global level and give them an opportunity to be able to travel, have those experiences, meet these people through the back door, as well as other types of food producers in those regions around the world. So that being said, you know, we started with our couple tours in Europe because my partner Chris George and I thought, wow, who doesn't want to go to England and France, right? And that's where we
want to go.
I know, and we spent a lot of time there. We love it. We never get tired of it. But an opportunity came up to think about building the first tour here in the U.S. because we wanted to highlight all of the great producers and the interesting and amazing things that are happening in cheese production on the West Coast, clear to the East Coast, and an opportunity came up to feature Oregon.
So why Oregon, though?
Well, we love Oregon.
Why do you love Oregon?
It's amazing.
I love it too.
Yeah, but yeah. It's so unique, right? We were actually approached by some of the producers there. Our friend David Gremmel, you know, at Rogue Creamery.
Absolutely.
And all of the folks there. And of course, we knew Steve Jones in Portland. And Max McCallman, who has been such a supporter of Cheese Journeys and has been involved with several of our tours, and I decided Oregon needs to be the place we go first here in the U.S. So we very aggressively in the last 6-8 months started to put plans together to build the tour.
Where, you know, how did you decide where to go? I mean, I know that there's Rogue, and everybody knows Rogue because they're awesome. But how did you branch out from there? Did Steve help you find some smaller producers you didn't know existed?
You know, that's what's so remarkable about Oregon. And when you look at not just the cheese producers, but a lot of the peripheral support that they have to produce or to support food, farm-to-table, food industry, producers, excellent restaurants, small producers, they have a great amount of people willing to, when you say, hey, I want to do this, they're there for you. And so I left the Fancy Foods Show in January, and I rented a car, and I headed north and didn't stop till I'd been to almost pretty much the whole area of the state.
That's a big state.
Very big. That was our biggest challenge, Greg, because, you know, you're talking about how do you do all this in a week or 10 days? There's so much there. And then, of course, if you're not just talking about cheese and you're talking about wine and beer production and everything related to all of that, you could spend a month. It's pretty cool.
I mean, I think that it's great. I want to just give a little anecdotal, you know, thing here. You know, your gals were having a beer or several beers. I don't know if they have more than one beer. I've seen them have more than one beer. I think at the cheese bar, and they ran into one of my good friends who's also named Greg, and he started a little company out there called Cowbell.
Yep.
And Greg goes all around the Pacific Northwest and gathers cheeses, and he works with the makers. He gives feedback to them, and then he sends them to me, you know, out here on the East Coast. And it was just such a funny little story because, you know, he's sitting there and your gals are talking about the Essex Street Cheese Company. And he's like, yeah, I used to work for them. And they're like, well, who the hell are you? Because there's only four employees. and he was the guy who actually built the original stall that we had back in the Essex Street Market.
Yeah.
He was a carpenter.
The very beginning.
Yeah, and he's a great cheesemonger. And yeah. Through him, I've been able to see so many more cheeses and so much more of the things. I've never been to Oregon. You know, I'm a coach. I just, first of all, I can't get away from Italy, so I can't do it. But
right. But
I can understand why you would want to go there.
Yeah, you know, it takes a lot to just pull. I mean, to actually build a tour with great producers is one thing. But then what is so beautiful about Oregon is not only just the food, the producers, the people are amazing, the culture, but also, of course, the scenery. Who doesn't love
it's gorgeous
all of
there.
What's there? And that became then part of this tour as well. And we decided to actually call this tour an enthusiast tour, even though we have professionals who will be traveling with us, I'm sure, because we wanted to include and slow it down and enjoy everything that's related to Oregon and not just food in a very fast-paced kind of educational, you know, strictly educational type tour.
So you fell in love with it.
Yeah. You know, we start in Portland. We graze. We don't just do the high-end kind of stuff and only the cheese stuff. We do a lot of mix. We do coffee tour. We do a beer crawl. We do all sorts of cool, fun things with Steve in Portland. And, of course, we're going to spend a little time at his new place there, and we love that. And then we'll be heading south to wine country.
There's some good
production
wine out there.
Some good wines. And then how could you not go to the coast, right? So you got to get over to Newport because some of our favorite people I met were the Rogue Ale folks. How do you not like what they do with beer?
Dead Guy Ale is awesome stuff.
You know, they roll out the red carpet for us when we were there. They were so hospitable. We went to the farm and to see some of their small batch productions and now some of their spirits that they're working on. Very interesting and just a great...
What are they making?
Oh, some really cool stuff. Whiskey, of course. They've got a bourbon going, several different ages. Some nice mix of... They're growing a lot of their... Not just their hops, you know, some of their specialty hops, but, you know, they got their own bees and various different things that are going on there, and that'll all be incorporated into the tour as well.
That's one thing I've always, from afar, admired about the food scene from afar in Portland and in Oregon in general. Is that it's a 360 thing. It's not like, hey, we're going to buy some hops from Jim and that lives in England and make some beer. Everything's sort of grown from the ground up there. Am I wrong to assume that?
No, I think they have a very focused vision of how they can best collaborate and be sustainable and help their neighbor with a lot of their production and goals and work together in a much more advanced collaborative way that sometimes you just don't see in other you know, markets.
How's that trip filling up for you?
Well, we just released it this weekend, so we kind of like to invite people to take a look at our website, cheesejourneys.com, and enjoy the beautiful artwork there that my partner Chris George has put together and the inviting details of all of what we're going to be doing. And as we work our way down from Portland we finished the tour at the end of 10 days at our favorite event, the Oregon Guild Cheese Festival, and we're hosted by those friends there at the Cheesemaker Dinner. We have private invites and events going on, and of course, the amazing thing there is any of the cheesemakers that we happen to miss along the way because we couldn't do them all, it will culminate in that weekend event down in near Ashland, and a great opportunity to really spend time with all of those great folks.
Anything that's I like any festival I can get my hands on, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Food festivals are like the best.
And you know, that one's tried and tested. It's an amazing event, and they not only just are featuring Oregon, but you'll see people from Vermont there, California's going to be there. Just a real opportunity to see all of what's going on in that community.
That's great. In a world that gets scarier every day, I'm glad that good things are growing, you know, in little pockets of the world. It makes me a very happy man.
Well, you know, and the one thing about Oregon, you have to kind of mentally prepare yourself. You know, if you've been living in New York City for any length of time and you spend a little time in Oregon, you start to realize things slow down. And that's one of the facets of this trip is it's slow, it's relaxing, it's interesting, and you get to appreciate, like anywhere we go, the unique culture that is kind of around all of these producers and why they do what they do.
So you mean I can't just, like, shove people out of the way when I go there? Is that what you're saying?
Well, Greg, you might just enjoy sleeping in a little bit. And,
I love sleeping in.
not having to go at breakneck pace, right?
No, that's awesome. I always love to talk to you. And I wanted to just touch on your other cheese journeys that you have in September. Do you have any spots left on those? You guys are going to England and you're going to France, right?
Right. You know, we built two different tours for September. So John and I will be over there for 4 or 5, 6 weeks. And, of course, the opportunity is that you can travel the first of the month in September. We still have a few places left for our France tour, which is going to be in the Savoie, Alsace, and Jura regions. And, you know, those are just amazing alpine regions, some great wines, great cheeses. And we'll be traveling with Max McCollman and Laura Downey from Fairfield Cheese, which we just love.
I love the Jura. The Jura is like... has some of, like, the strangest wine. It tastes like petrol, but my favorite philosopher, Hermann Hesse, came from there. So when I traveled there, I always felt very close to him, and I thought I understood him, you know, a little bit better. And when you go to the Fortress of Saint Antoine,
right, we'll be there for a day.
You just don't come back the same person after you go to that place.
You're so right, Greg. I you speak from experience. I know, and to spend time and work with their people there, enjoy a lunch at the fort, and see the Cathedral of Comté cheese is life altering. Really amazing. They do a beautiful job.
Anna, man, I just want to thank you so much for coming on today. I love to talk to you. You know, you're fantastic.
Good to talk to you too.
And you know, if you haven't signed up for the Cheese Journeys in Europe, get it done and get on this Oregon trip. You know, stay tuned next week for Diane Stemple's book review. And in July, we have some more amazing post Fancy Food Show pre ACS conference episodes planned. We're all looking forward to it, and thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more Cutting the Curd live in the Heritage Radio Network. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.